So welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, the chairman of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We also welcome our listening audience, both on the radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Michael Sheldon, whom I met through his writing on autobiography, Mark Twain, Man in White. And excellent job. As I said last time, this is certainly the absolute best book about Mark Twain's final years that's around. No arguments to get a PhD thesis, kind of way off on the end, but a very balanced viewpoint about what was going on and his big successes at that time. A lot of time people think of him as an embittered old man or something like that because that fits the thesis. But in spite of the fact that he was grouchy some of the time, he was not an embittered old man. He was having a lot of fun. And it's sort of crucial, I think, to understand that. So Michael wrote that, but he also wrote an excellent biography of Orwell, 1994, 1990, something like that. And also another excellent biography he's written on Cyril Connolly and on Graham Greene as well. And right now he's working on a biography of Winston Churchill, and he happened to be in town for another event. So I asked him to come and speak to us right before the election, you know, with three great political observers in his biographical I would say oeuvre, but I probably will mispronounce it. I thought the insight would be just great. So, Michael.
I want to take you to start things off to a September night in 1908 when Mark Twain had moved in that summer to a brand new house he had built in these last years of his life. And the house was huge. It was about 40 rooms. It was in Redding, Connecticut, out in the countryside, very isolated spot. And late that night in September, the one I'm referring to, the household staff were wakened by the sounds of someone breaking into the house. And they went down. Mark Twain slept through the whole thing. But they went down to find out what was going on, and they discovered two really rather desperate men had broken into the house and were stealing whatever they could get their hands on. The butler actually fired a shot at these men, scaring them off, of course, and they ran away with various pieces of silver clinking in their pockets as they ran down the hill. These weren't the best burglars in the world because their getaway plan was to take the local commuter train back to New York in the morning. So they hid out in the woods, and that morning they managed to get on one of the commuter trains and go back into New York from Western Connecticut, where Redding is. But the local deputy sheriff was waiting for them, and there was another shootout, this time on the train, with some of the commuters hitting the floorboards of the train as bullets flew back and forth. Both of the burglars were wounded, badly wounded. The deputy sheriff was wounded. And by the time they got back to Redding, to the town hall, both the sheriff and the two burglars were very badly hurt and bandaged, and blood was all over them. One person described this as looking like gore on the side of the sheriff's pants and on the burglars' faces. And as these two men sat in the Redding town center waiting to be arraigned, in came, bright and early that morning, a man dressed entirely in white. And, of course, it's that man that's staring at you from the book cover back there. It's Mark Twain in his now trademark white suit. And he walked up to these two burglars, both of whom seemed to be in their 20s, and he looked very hard at them, and they realized, of course, who he was immediately. And he walked up to one of them finally, and he leaned over him, and he said, "You know, son, if you keep this up, one day you'll be in the United States Senate." And I think that sums up Mark Twain's attitude toward politics. He said, and he's very famous for saying, the United States has no native criminal class except Congress. And he also was very jaundiced and very cynical about Washington, D.C. as just simply a place to work. People sometimes forget, even if they once ran across the reference, that he worked for a while in Washington, D.C., hated it, thought the entire place was corrupt, and rarely went back there again, except when he wanted something. And my book on Mark Twain, Man and White, actually begins on the steps of the Library of Congress, where Twain has gone to appear at a congressional hearing on copyright, because he wants it extended in perpetuity if he can get it, but at least 50 years after the author's death, if that's the thing that's possible. And he lobbied the congressmen and the senators for this extension very vigorously. In fact, he took over the speaker's office. Can you imagine Nancy Pelosi letting a writer take over her office while he lobbies the members of Congress for some particular bill? But Mark Twain was so well-liked that he could get away with that. And that's the key, really, to his political viewpoint. I would say he was a party of one. And that's in relationship not only to political matters, but also even in relationship to God. A woman once came up to him in this great period of his success in his later years and said to him, almost gushingly, "How God must love you." And he said, "Well, thank you." But out of her hearing, he said under his breath, he said, "I guess she hasn't heard of our strained relations." And people have asked me if I thought Mark Twain believed in God, and I said, yes, I think he did. That isn't the problem. The problem is that he thought God was a lesser Mark Twain. And I really do believe that's the case, that he believed he could have managed the universe a lot better than God. And that's why when you talk about politics and Mark Twain, you're talking about an almost cosmic universal level. It isn't simply the United States he would want to reform, it's the world. He even said at one point, the Tsar has agreed to disarm. If the British disarm, I'm going to talk to the British. I have it all together. Let's see what we can do. He was willing to play international statesman, if that's what it took, in order to get people to behave themselves and be almost as good as Mark Twain. And I say a political party of one because you can look far and wide in Mark Twain's work and you will not find much in the way of specific discussion of whether he's inclined to support the Democrats or the Republicans. Generally, he tended to go more toward the Democrats in a time when the Republicans were really in power for most of that time. He hated, one of the few politicians he really hated was, surprisingly enough, Teddy Roosevelt. He said Teddy Roosevelt, as far as showing off, was much worse than Tom Sawyer, because he believed that the Great White Fleet that Roosevelt organized to tour the world and show off America's new imperial power was disgusting. And he argues quite strongly in the new autobiography, well, at least parts of it are new, that has been published this year, that that whole business of America becoming an imperial power was a huge mistake, and that getting involved in places like the Philippines or even in Cuba, which he initially supported because the regime was so corrupt down there, that was a violation of America's own basic principles. And when people ask me today about what Mark Twain would think of this or that, I always kind of resist those things because who knows really what he would have thought. But I don't have any doubt that he would be one of the strongest, fiercest voices against our involvement in overseas adventures. He would have said, "Why in God's name are we in these places doing what we're doing?" And he would have, I think, said a misguided way, and that our best job was to stay here and do what we could to reform ourselves first and then look at the world elsewhere if we had the time. He used to say about the Christian missionaries, which would go over to China or to Africa, he would say, "Oh, missionaries, come back home and reform and save the Christians here," because he believed that they were not behaving in a way that was proper. If you look at political things through Mark Twain's eyes, you're really looking at things through Mark Twain's eyes. That's all you're seeing. You're not seeing Democrat, Republican in the final analysis. You're seeing a man who has a worldview that is uniquely his, that depends upon common sense and goodwill and not necessarily on a party platform. But the interesting thing about my new subject with Winston Churchill is that he is a party politician, and in Britain, that's the name of the game, party politics. So from the get-go, he's a man who's trying to figure out where he's going to stand within a particular political party and how he's going to climb up the ladder to success in that party system. Now, Mark Twain would never have anything to do with that. That would be far too bureaucratic, far too organized for Mark Twain. But one of the brilliant things about Churchill is that he has some of that same flair and independence that Mark Twain had, and indeed some of the same humor, as you'll see in a minute. But he also has that ability to look at organization and even at vision, political vision, true political vision, in a way that's not only beyond what we have today, but stands out, I think, in history as a singular talent. And let me give you an idea of how that works. You probably know that this whole political system in Britain couldn't confine Churchill to one party. He began as a Tory, a conservative, quickly shifted to a liberal in the dying days of the Liberal Party. I mean, people thought it was going to succeed, but in fact they were quickly on their way to being replaced by what is today the Labour Party. And then when that sort of ran its course, he shifted back to the Conservative Party. So Churchill was very prominently involved in two of the most important parties of his time. It would be as though someone had shifted from being a Democrat to a Republican and back to a Democrat again, or any other combination you want to suggest. And Churchill survived all these moves because each time he would move to a different party, they were glad to have him. They recognized his talents. They recognized that whoever he would be supporting, he would be a jewel. So a jewel in their particular organization. So he held major office in both parties. And, of course, this could only last for a short time. You could only get away with this, really, over a certain period, and he did it for about 25 years. And finally, it all just came to a crash in the 1930s. And at that point, as many people know, Churchill was considered to be out in the wilderness without really an office in order to use his great talents. It's no coincidence that when Britain needed him most at the end of that period in 1940, they knew to turn to him. They knew that he was the man of talents, though now a man in his 60s, who could save, and it needs to be stated very powerfully, who could save that country. And I'll give you an example of what I mean by save in a little bit. There's a statement of Mark Twain's that has to do with something about Churchill. Mark Twain went to receive a degree, an Oxford degree, an honorary degree in England, and he was introduced to Winston Churchill. And he said, I think that's the coming man. I think that's the man, even though at that point Churchill was barely out of his 20s, who would amount to greatness. It was as though one man of greatness recognized the greatness in another man. And I love those moments where two men of very great stature meet each other, almost ships passing in the night, and realize that what they're seeing on the other side is something, if not equally great, certainly a very important stature. And I think Churchill was the sort of person who expected that in everyone he came across, that they would be, as we know him to be, a big thinker, a man who played out his life on a large stage. And he was offended when he came across people who didn't see life in that same way. He was once told by, I think it was President Truman, that his successor after the war, after the Second World War, Clement Attlee, was a modest man. And Churchill responded, yes, he has much to be modest about. Because he thought Attlee was a little man, that Attlee was not a man of great vision as he was. And he really resented anybody who was playing the game with him on the same playing field who did not look at history and politics and life in that way. He once said, I'll read you something very interesting. He once said to Sir John French, a general in the First World War, right near the beginning of that war, he said, we are on the stage of history. And the operative word there is not so much history, it's stage. Because I think Churchill, one of the things that's most interesting about him and a key to his personality is that he was a great actor. And I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, I mean that in a very positive sense, that he understood that on the stage of history, he had a great part to play. And after all, he grew up at Blenheim Palace in the shadow of ancestors who had already played such a great part on that stage that they had been rewarded with a palace. The Duke of Marlborough, his ancestor, had won great battles and had been given that palace as a reward for his work. And Churchill, as a young boy living there, realized he was standing in the shadow of greatness and that one day he would have a part to play. So when he would say to his fellow actors, as he came to think of them on this stage of history, you must remember that that's what you're doing. You're playing on this large stage. It's not by coincidence, by the way, and this is one of the things that I'll be making a great deal of in my book on Churchill, which is really about his early life, that he proposed to three women before he was accepted by his wonderful wife of many years, Clementine. And of those three women, two were actresses. And one of them is very famous, Ethel Barrymore. He was deeply smitten by Ethel Barrymore, also by a woman who's been totally forgotten in history, but is a very interesting woman, Muriel Wilson. Her family had a great deal of money. She didn't really have to work. And she was one of the great and most renowned amateur actresses of her time and was featured in the magazines of the time in costume from her various parts all the time, as was Churchill's American mother, Jenny, who would constantly dress up and put on amateur theatricals and star in them. And Churchill would often have a picture of his mother near his study or his bedside wearing one of her favorite costumes from some party she had attended or from some theatrical event that she had participated in. She, probably more than anyone else, helped to inspire in him this sense of theater, that they were involved in a kind of grand theatrical event called history. And there the operative word is story. There is a great story to be told, and Churchill knew it almost from the beginning and constantly was living his life as though he had an idea in mind of planning a story. I'll give you a great example of this in his most famous speech. You'll know it. He was constantly referring, by the way, to Britain as an island because he was very much aware of the fact that this island nation was isolated, needed a great navy to protect it, needed a sense of theater in order to project its power. And no wonder such great theatrical talents have come from England because of this sense that otherwise it would be Iceland. You know, otherwise it would be an obscure island in the middle of nowhere. And yet it had this sense of its own greatness. And Churchill was attuned to that in a way that was truly remarkable, so that when the chips were really down, when he was called back from the wilderness to serve as prime minister and save the country, he gave this speech. We shall defend our island. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And what's often missed in that speech is the way that Churchill is in that speech unfolding a picture, as though to say, I already have the story written. The story is, if we're invaded, we will fight, and we will fight here, we will fight there, we will continue this fight. The story, if it ends, will end with us in a position refusing to surrender. And at one point, when there was doubt about this, he made a very interesting comment that brings us back to this. He was asked, what happens if we lose? And he said, if we lose, our story is told, meaning it's over. A normal politician would have said, if we're defeated, that's the end of England. If we're defeated, that will be the apocalypse or Armageddon. But he saw it as the end of the story. And he did not want that story to end in humiliation. He did not want that story to end in defeat. He wanted that story to end with Winston Churchill as the savior of his nation. And what's extraordinary is that it did end that way. When I was doing interviews for my biography of Graham Greene, I stood on a hill, a really more of a rise, about 2 miles from the cliffs of Dover. And I was there at the home of a woman who had known Graham Greene, and I was interviewing her. And by this time, she was an elderly woman. And probably I had interviewed her for too long, so she was taking a break, and I was standing outside of her house looking down at the English Channel, which was about 2 miles away. And it so happened she owned all the land between where I was standing and the channel. She's a very wealthy woman. And standing beside me, because he'd come out of the house, was her son, who was the head of the British nuclear submarine fleet. And having him there and sort of thoughts running through my head, I just looked out there at this misty scene along the shores of the English Channel, and I said to him, if the Germans had invaded down there in 1940, as everyone feared they would they have taken the country? And I was surprised by his quick answer. What do you think it was? It was yes. He said, oh, we couldn't have stopped them. He seemed convinced that if they had landed, that would have been it, that the Germans, if they had gotten up the gumption to do what everyone expected them to do, it really would have been the end, as Churchill said, of the story. Now, I think Churchill knew that. And Churchill was a great gambler. He liked to spend a lot of his time in the south of France at Monte Carlo, at the casino. And I think in all the things that have been written and said about Churchill, rarely have we heard that what he pulled off was one of the greatest gambles in history. He was a man who had already fought the Kaiser. He was a man who was the head of the British Navy while he was still in his 30s when the First World War broke out, determined to use that Navy to defend, as he would always say, this island nation. And, of course, that echoes a bit of Shakespeare, doesn't it, in that same notion of this island. And I think what he did through his power of speech, and that's really what it was, wasn't it? Radio programs broadcast first to the British people, but then, of course, available to the Germans if they wanted to hear them. And that was a call to action that was so convincing, so powerful, so dramatic, yes, and I think that's an important word to stress, dramatic, that it managed to convince even Adolf Hitler it would be a mistake to tackle this actor in this drama and meet him face to face on the same stage. And that's really what Churchill was setting forth. He was setting a stage, and literally in his mind, a stage for a meeting with Adolf Hitler, whom he usually dismissed by the words Corporal Hitler, referring to his rank in the First World War, when Churchill himself had distinguished himself not only in the Navy, but also in the trenches. He had served as well. So he was coming to this fight not only with a sense of his own importance and drama, but with experience and with knowledge. And in this particular confrontation, Hitler blinked. That's what he did. And by that blink, Churchill proved that this, as he put it in his most famous phrase, would be England's finest hour. And what you have there in that phrase, which everyone knows, everyone is familiar with the phrase, their finest hour. But what they forget is that it often comes with a preface where he says, if the British Empire lasts 1,000 years, men will still say this was their finest hour. Already he's projecting out another millennium to say, no matter how long this story goes, they'll still come back to this moment and see the drama as the kind of drama played on the stage where you could walk away from that drama and say, that was his finest hour of an actor. And that's what it would often be said. That was his finest hour on the stage. Here we have a country that is theatrical by heart, which has produced such great playwrights and such great actors. And I think it's often overlooked that Winston Churchill was one of the greatest actors England ever produced. But an actor in a greater sense than simply that of a person with theatrical talents, a person aware that he could change history through the power of his theatrics. And part of that power, of course, was manifested in this extraordinary ability he had with language, but also in his notion that what he was the director of was not just a military power and a nation, but of a story. And that story would come to pass, as he hoped it would, in victory. If you ever go to Blenheim Palace, and I would urge you to do so, it's an extraordinary place. And if you stand in the forecourt of Blenheim Palace, what you see above you are towering columns and arches and all sorts of things. But at the top of this, you see various martial items, drums, cannonballs, swords, all the things that you would associate with somebody who had been a victorious military chieftain. And I think standing there among those things as a little boy, there came into Churchill's mind the idea that he would have this role to play as a warrior, as a leader who would have to pull off something extraordinary in the sense of war. And the fact that he did it not with the cannonballs, not with the swords, not with many of the weapons he himself had used early on in his career. You know, he was in the last major charge of the British cavalry, where they used swords and pistols and lances and charged in an old-fashioned thing where you charge the enemy, and who knows who ends up at the end of it, alive or dead. In fact, many of Churchill's friends in this charge ended up dead. I'll just interrupt to tell you a great story at that moment. Churchill came back bloodied from that experience, but still in one piece. But one of his friends had had his wrist cut very deeply. And the field hospital doctor looked at young Churchill and said, "I need a skin graft." And Churchill rolled up his sleeve and allowed the doctor, with an old straight edge razor, to cut, without any anesthesia, to cut a strip of skin from his arm and place it as a graft into this fellow's hand. Churchill said, "I think it did him a world of good afterwards." And when this fellow, by the way, died before Churchill, Churchill said, "He's taking it with him before me." He felt it was going on ahead, that they would both end up in the same place for their valor. He knew about those instruments of war, the physical instruments of war. And yet, the way he pulled off the greatest gamble of the century was to use a very unusual instrument of war, words. And to use them in such a way that it so intimidated Hitler that Hitler hesitated long enough for Britain to build up its strength and to tackle what would eventually be the conquest of Germany. It's something I don't think we can repeat enough, that in our way of looking at history, here we have one human being who just through sheer wizardry with words could manage to save an entire nation, and probably us as well. You know, when we finally reached Germany, some officers from the United States commando forces made a point immediately of capturing Wernher von Braun, who was designing rockets for Hitler. And we know that he was designing very, very sophisticated rockets, because when they took him to Huntsville, Alabama, and put him to work for the United States, he designed the rocket that sent us to the moon. So in the case of Hitler, time was everything. He had the scientists. He had a lot of the science. Churchill used to call it perverted science that might have delivered the war to Hitler's hands if he had had more time. The crucial thing about Churchill is he denied Hitler that time, and he did it through this fantastic bluff. Now, you may wonder, where does George Orwell fit into all of this? Well, he fits in brilliantly, actually. You may know that the hero of 1984 is Winston Smith. It wasn't as though Orwell was paying any great tribute to Churchill, about whom he was very suspicious. Churchill was much too grand an actor for, I think, Orwell's taste. And in fact, what's interesting is that Orwell's kind of the anti-Churchill. He's the man who doesn't see the world as the great stage that England must play out on. He's the man who constantly looks back not to the empire that England has, but to the villages and farms it has. He's a man who's constantly in his work directing our attention back to that bucolic England, that England of shopkeepers, that England of small farmers. And it's no coincidence that this is the man who writes a book called Animal Farm. And this is a man who once kept a shop himself. He opened a small village shop. While he was a major writer, he was also a shopkeeper. This meant a lot to him. And I think he consistently wanted to see England's profile in the world reduced rather than increased, and its theatrics and dramatics taken away from the stage and put on a far more personal and reasonable level, a level of common sense, like Orwell himself. But you know, the one thing that unites these two men, and you probably wouldn't be surprised by this, is their love of the greatest instrument that culture produced, and that is our instrument also, the English language. You will not find two greater lovers of the English language, and I mean this in the sense almost of a physical sense, lovers of English than George Orwell and Winston Churchill. And if they had ever met, I don't think they ever did as far as I know, but if they had and had talked, the one subject that would have engaged them most was the subject they shared this passion for, the language. In fact, you may know that Orwell's, one of his greatest essays, is called Politics in the English Language. Isn't this nice how this all comes around? But it does. And it's Politics in the English Language that is still studied in schools today very much because it tells us constantly to be aware of how language can be used to distort our perceptions of reality, especially political realities. That you can kill civilians and dismiss it with the phrase collateral damage. That you can do all sorts of awful things and find a convenient or casual phrase to disguise the awfulness of it. And Churchill, I found, rather to my delight, once stood up in the House of Commons and gave quite an impassioned speech about this creeping use of euphemism in politics. He said, "I understand the new Labour government is now referring to housing as accommodation." He said, "What am I supposed to do? I always think of it as a home, as in my sweet home. Am I to begin to sing My Sweet Accommodation?" And of course, he realized that using words other than the simplest ones, the good old Anglo-Saxon ones, for example, would always carry the potential for misleading people into not understanding the facts as they were on the ground. That if you didn't give plain names to plain things, you were always in danger of distorting reality and misleading whoever you wanted to mislead. So that the key instrument in his greatest novel, in Orwell's greatest novel, 1984, is not physical torture. The game is almost too late when you have to apply physical torture. It's the instrument that censors thought before thought gets a chance to get off the ground. It is the language that Big Brother invents for his society, which he dubs Newspeak. And if you read carefully in 1984, you actually see Orwell give a figure for Newspeak. And the figure is, it's a language that eventually will be reduced to 900 words. And you can say a lot with 900 words, actually. Many college freshmen from studies that have been done are seen to have somewhere between 6,000 and 8,000 words total vocabulary. So, you know, you're not really curtailing a lot to get down to 900. But when you get down to 900, as Orwell realized, you would begin to shade away any kind of subtleties and leave people with fairly stark black and whites, which you could define in your own terms and leave them incapable of thought because their vocabulary, their limited resources would not allow them even to conceive of the ways in which they would have to revolt against an oppressive tyranny such as the one that Big Brother wants to institute. That use of language in 1984 is something that Churchill would have responded to right away, and in fact, we know he did. Shortly after Orwell's death, as you may know, he died within months of finishing 1984. Churchill was reading 1984 when his doctor came in. And fortunately, his doctor kept a diary and noted the delight that Churchill was taking in reading this book because he understood instinctively, I think, that what Orwell was talking about, though they would have their differences politically on many grounds, was something they could share an interest and a faith in, and that is the magnificent power of the English language either to liberate or to confine, either to mislead or to enlighten. And that power is not overestimated by Orwell. He puts every bit of intellectual energy he can into explaining that power and how it can be used. And, of course, here we have in the example of Churchill a man who put that power to use and knew, if no one else did, knew the result that he had saved, as he would have said, Western civilization from sure destruction by backing down the worst human being of the 20th century. As I think we can agree, Churchill was one of the best people of the 20th century. I want to end just by giving you an odd quote from Mark Twain, because I'd just written a review of the new autobiography, and I was rather happy, pleased to see this quotation from Mark Twain, written in 1906. Tell me this doesn't describe us 100 years later. These are Mark Twain's words. "Look at the candidates whom we loathe 1 year and are afraid to vote against the next, whom we cover with unimaginable filth 1 year and fall down on the public platform and worship the next, and keep on doing it until the habitual shutting of our eyes to last year's evidence brings us presently to a sincere and stupid belief in this year's evidence." We go on making the same mistake, worshiping, I think Twain would have said, false idols, but then putting other idols in their place that are probably equally false. And at some point, I think he would have said, open your eyes. And if I had finally to give you a description of each of these three men and their political viewpoints, I would say this. Mark Twain was the incorrigible independent. Churchill was the liberal conservative. And Orwell was the dissident liberal. He was the man who would always make trouble in any party he belonged to because he was always the dissident. And of these three people, I can't choose which I admire most for their views, except that the weight of my feeling now has fallen very, very much in Churchill's favor, because of these three men, he was the man of action who did something most men of thought, most women of thought, most people of thought never are able to do, to finally put their thought to the test in the real world and see, in his case, that it succeeded. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael, for that great talk. But just to remind our audience, it's Michael Sheldon, the author of Orwell, Mark Twain, Man in White, and is currently working on a biography of Churchill, speaking here at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. Now we have probably plenty of questions. The first thing I'd like to start off with, to get the Q&A started, is the general principles, I think, are pretty easily applied to current elections and everything. But having studied this, the big trends in each of these men's lives, do you see any big trends in the way that the politics of the 21st century have gone? Do you think some people are arguing it's uphill, some people are arguing it's downhill,
It's getting much worse, isn't it? I mean, it is. It's getting all of these trends that these men noticed coming have gotten worse. When I noticed Twain used that word, unimaginable filth, and you look at what's been happening in the election this year, in which people have accused each other on both sides of the worst possible things. They just throw... Now there's no shame, is there? There's just total abandon in this. And the idea is to run commercials against your opponent in which you demonize them almost from the start. And when I think Twain uses that word unimaginable filth, it really strikes a chord, because that's the way sometimes you feel we've descended in our politics. To the point where now we know it's filth, but we're more accepting of it and not as certainly as shocked by it as I think Twain would have expected us to be.
Losing the shock value means it's so common. Right?
Yeah. On both sides.
On both sides, yeah. Mm-hmm. And as you said, I mean, I think it's the political advertising is imagery. It's a fight of imagery instead of any factual elements. A little bit more maybe about the language, the newspeak language. I thought that was, get it down to 900 words. I think I read someplace a while back that USA Today had a vocabulary that was intended to be under 2,000 words or something like that.
It's amazing if you think about it how much you can say, but you can't engage in the kind of sophisticated thought Orwell wanted ordinary citizens to be able to do if over a period of time, through an educational system that's heavily controlled, you reduce people's vocabulary consistently over and over to 900 words. And as you can see now, even with a lot of our young people having gone to great schools and things, they're perhaps relying a little too much on the word like. So like I was going, like I was, and And in a way, you can see Newspeak at work if you wonder about the mechanics of it. That's how the mechanics work. You try to eliminate more sophisticated words from a vocabulary so that you can't make more sophisticated points. And by the way, I'd also point out that one of Orwell's great moments, which to some extent was referred to in the very famous Apple Macintosh commercial of 1984, The 2 Minutes Hate, where a figure appears on, Orwell would have said, the telescreen, and for 2 minutes demonizes the opponents of the regime so much that the audience is just worked up into a lather, a fever of hate toward their opponents. And this is something I think we're seeing now on our screens, except that it's not as Orwell predicted that the dictator or the big brother would be pushing this. It would be us, all of us, pushing this. Here's my opponent. Look what an awful person they are. Hate them, love me, hate them, hate them, love me. And to do that constantly, to bombard us with these images of hate, that was Orwell's idea for a dictatorship, not for a democracy. And yet we're trending in that way.
I remember thinking, you know, when I wrote 1984 many, many, many years ago, that, yes, the language is sort of under assault with the diminishment of the vocabulary and so on. But at the same time, then I thought, well, you know, it started with a relatively small vocabulary. And how did it get bigger? And it got bigger through minds that aren't small, using the words in slightly different ways, expanding the vocabulary. Look how much Shakespeare added to the vocabulary, how much different writers in America, in English history and then American history add to the vocabulary. And that actually, I shifted around and I said it's sort of the writer's job to make a language more sophisticated so that other people who don't think that way all by themselves now have that opportunity to do so. But I think that those writers themselves would think sophisticatedly even with 900 words.
It might be possible, but there's a suppleness to English which I think comes from its enormously large vocabulary. We have words, if you look at the dictionary that's considered the gold standard in this, the Oxford English Dictionary, that now total about 500,000. Now, many of those words have fallen out of use, but nevertheless, as a total of what we've accumulated in the Oxford English Dictionary, you're looking at 500,000 words. And Orwell used to say about writing, he said, when people write poorly, this is what happens to them. They have choices to make about diction, about grammar. And he said, if they take the lesser choice, if they take the easy choice, their thought will not be as good. They will not be able to nail the thought as well. So he said, I always work to take the harder choice. And the thing that English makes possible with its large vocabulary are a lot of choices. You know, we can describe things 17, 20 different ways in our language. And yet we still don't have so many words for the common things that most of us encounter in everyday life. I always point this out to my students, that we still don't have a good word for what happens when you meet someone in the hallway that you don't know, and you're in their path, and you try to move to get out of their path, and they try to move out of your path, and the two of you do this kind of dance together. And I say to my students, what's that dance called? And nobody has a name for it. But it's one of the things that with a language with 500,000 words, you'd think we would have given a name to before this stage. But we don't.
Well, I guess my long-range optimism makes me think that if the language contracts down to 900 words, that there will be minds that will push it back out again in the other direction. But having the hundreds of years of language and these writers makes it easier on all the rest of us. I got that impression, too, from the German language. I did some work in Germany several years ago, and one of the lawyers I was working with was writing a letter just requesting the money that he was owed. And he was writing it in English, but it was translating his normal German. And it was very, very flowery, and it went on and on and on because it was polite German. And the grammar wasn't direct and so on and so forth. And I said, you know, if you send a letter like that to Goldman Sachs, they're just not going to pay you for a year and a half. You know, you have to send them a letter saying, you know, we did a great job, and this is what you owe us, and send it. You know, within 30 days or we'll start charging interest. He said, that's so impolite. It offended his sense. And I said, you know, what Germany really needs is a couple of top-rank writers that allow other intellectuals the chance to say things clearly and straightforward and still not lose their rank in their own minds as intellectuals, because know, what Twain has done, what Hemingway did, what other writers have done to make transparency and directness in English an intellectually acceptable way of talking. It hasn't been done in German yet because everybody wants to be Kant and Hegel.
Yeah. People forget, by the way, that Churchill won the Nobel Prize in Literature, that he was regarded so well as a writer that he won the highest prize there is. And he's not, by literary critics, taken seriously as a writer. In fact, you almost always hear people refer to the bombast of his rhetoric. I don't see it that way at all. And in fact, when I isolated that phrase for you of the finest hour, I think that's one way of demonstrating how you have to take the way you look at language to a different level than most literary critics are doing. They're looking at writers who never do anything other than write, which is a noble thing, but nevertheless, they're not running countries, they're not running businesses, they're not establishing or taking apart empires. And for me, what's so interesting about Churchill is to take a man with the sensitivity to language and words that I have from being a literary biographer and to see him use those in the field of action. And, you know, it brings to mind the case of a play that was actually Churchill's favorite of Shakespeare's, Hamlet, in which Prince Hamlet has to decide, after being a grad student at the University of Wittenberg for so many years, if he will take up arms and do anything to change the situation he's walked into, where here he is, this Renaissance prince, walking into a bloodbath. And the question is, what will I do? And I think Churchill looked at a situation like that and said, I take up arms. And he did. And what I'm finding interesting as somebody who's been a literary critic for so long is to now go into a situation where I'm dealing with people in history who don't think that way and who see only the actions and not the words and who kind of diminish the words. And yet, if you think about it, all our greatest political figures have been people of words, from Martin Luther King to President Lincoln to Thomas Jefferson. The ones we ennoble are the ones whose words ennoble them. And I think that's one of the things I would like to bring out about Churchill. And it's not very fashionable right now, but I'm very happy to take that on, to say that, A, he did save civilization without any bones about it. He did. And B, he did it through the use of something that is normally considered almost superfluous. What does it matter? That's all just style. The words are just style. They could be bombast or not. No, in this case, I think the style was the sharpest-edged weapon in his arsenal.
One question on the date. What part of his career did he win the Nobel Prize? What year?
In the 1950s.
1950s, mm-hmm. So was it, yeah.
Thank you. Just to get it straight in my head, the history of it, without tying you to actual precise numbers, what were their relative ages between Mark Twain and Churchill when they had that encounter, and the relative age with Churchill and Hitler?
It's very interesting. At that time, Churchill was a very young man, just barely out of his 20s, and on the rise, as Mark Twain saw, whereas Mark Twain was now in his 70s and at the end of his life, and yet he could see something of the kind of youth he had been, adventurous, full of himself. And I don't know if I mentioned that there was to have been a meeting between Hitler and Churchill. It was to have occurred in Berlin in the early 30s when Churchill was out of power, and Hitler stood him up. Hitler didn't come to the meeting. And that's been passed off, I think, as a relatively minor thing, but I think it was hugely important. I think Hitler did not want to meet Churchill. I think in some sense he was afraid of him and continued to be intimidated by him, thank God.
We have Obama seen as a good orator, but things haven't gone as well for him as they did for Churchill. So could you kind of compare and contrast the two, what the difference is as to, you know, when both being good orators? But
I think it's a very interesting case, because here's a case where a man was able to dazzle people with words but not with actions. The actions somehow got muted. Either if you're in favor of what he did or if you're not in favor, the real contributions, the real actions didn't stand out in the way that actions of Churchill's would do, for good or for bad. Churchill made many mistakes, and the mistakes were as clear as the successes. Whereas I think the whole message of Obama has gotten muddled. And that's perhaps because it's a backlash to the clarity of his oratory at the beginning, where everything was put in such stark terms. I mean, could you get any more stark than hope and change? And when you offer things like that and you're unable to deliver, or you create a lot more dissension than you planned on doing, you suffer as a result of it. But don't forget, Churchill suffered. The most extraordinary thing about Churchill is he won the war and was kicked out of office. And kicked out of office by the man he considered to be mediocre, the man who was supposed to be such a very modest man, much to be modest about, Clement Attlee. So Churchill did not always have a smooth ride, and it's only in retrospect, I think, we can look back at Churchill's career and put the various bits in place. And my own experience as a biographer shows me that it takes at least half a century for us to put someone in perspective. So who knows how we'll look at this, at these moments today, 50 years from now. It may be that we'll be even more disappointed than we are. It may be that we'll see we were totally wrong in our perceptions of things. But it usually does take about a couple of generations for people to begin getting their eye on what actually happened and understanding it. And also, by the way, for the passions to die away that bring up partisans to attack you when you simply say the truth. In other words, if I'm talking about Mark Twain in his life, I'm not going to get many people who knew Mark Twain telling me I'm wrong, right? Because we can all discuss him dispassionately now. But if I were talking about him within 10 or 15 years of his death, there'd be a whole host of people out there say, well, I knew Mark Twain and you didn't know Mark Twain. And there you'd be. Historians have to remove themselves from all of that. They have to not look at things as though they've got a dog in the fight. They have to see things as though it's taking place on another planet. And that's why, for me, Churchill is very interesting. I worked for 15 years for a British newspaper, the Daily Telegraph. And I worked for them as their North American features correspondent. And I wrote in British English all that time. And I'm a guy from Oklahoma. But I got to know the culture pretty well. And it's perhaps because I stood between the two and that I've written books on George Orwell and Mark Twain that I can now come back to somebody like Winston Churchill and look at him afresh, I hope, and see things that people perhaps hadn't noticed before.
Yeah, if there hadn't been a finest hour, the expression, you know, where they won, the expression might have disappeared. And I think here where I think one of the difficulties for Obama is that he didn't focus totally on hope. He got a lot of changes, but he focused on hope, and two more years of bad economic times has made people angry. And people, the word this year is angry, not hope. You know, and that's the tough.
There's another question.
So looking at the situation today in comparison and looking at the decline you've talked about, what do you think are the factors that contribute to this decline in civility or this decline in intellectual rigor or intellectual content and political discourse, leading hopefully to some suggestions about how we could improve things? What needs to change?
Orwell answered that question for us. It's the sheer desire for power. In other words, in order to get power, if you become so committed to that you want to get it, but you don't have many talents to acquire it. Churchill acquired power through talent. But most people don't have that talent, so they acquire it through much more brutish methods. And the easiest way to do that is to come at your opponent with a large club rather than with a finely honed phrase. I think Churchill and his art of politics would do just as well today, in fact, maybe better. We'd be so stunned by it, you see. We would realize it was so important. And may I just point out to you before we finish here that there's one other very famous phrase of Churchill's which also fits into this theatrical thing, and it's never thought to fit that pattern, and that is his phrase about the Iron Curtain. Because when he used that phrase, he said, it has descended on Europe. And what he was seeing was exactly what we've seen him refer to about the English story being told. It would come to an end. And what I think he was really telling us about communism is what strangely has come to be true, that it was the end of an act, that with the conquest by the Soviet Union of those eastern countries, an iron curtain that couldn't be penetrated for a long time would descend and close, but that a second act, a third act would emerge. And when that wall came down in Berlin in 1989, 1990, I think we saw the second act and we're not yet to the third act. But it's Churchill always looking at history with the emphasis on story. And I think that's where history is so powerful, as a story we are all living and can feel almost viscerally. And the questions you've asked me here today illustrate how we all know we're living through history right now. And what we're wondering is, what Churchill wondered, how will the story end? And most of us don't live long enough to know. That's why history's so much fun. We can go back and end the story and say, he did save the country. He did do this, and give him the credit he's due. That, to me, is the thing that really is exciting about writing Winston Churchill's biography, is to put him square in the picture and to give him the credit he's due.
Now, I know this isn't the area that you've been studying, but we just talked about the fall of the Berlin Wall, and of course some people say that Ronald Reagan did it, and there are plenty of people in Poland who say that the Pope did it, et cetera, et cetera. Do you have any background on that? Because that's you know, you have Churchill as a central figure in World War II, a mind making decisions that makes all the difference in the world. Do you see anything like that, or do you think there was so many actors that there wasn't some?
Well, yes, because once you realize that the great secret here for us in understanding what's happening is to see it the way that Churchill saw it, you begin to see that all stories have their phases. They have their twists and turns. And we tend to want to end things very quickly because we may not live to see how they're going to sort themselves out. But a great historian, and Churchill, by the way, got his Nobel Prize in Literature for his great historical writing. He wrote a two-volume life of his ancestor, the Duke of Marlborough, which is just stunning. It's a great biography. He, by the way, used to joke that because he had written 5 books before he was 25, he used to say, by the time I was 25, I'd written more books than Moses. So he was constantly aware of how his vision was being shaped by our understanding of storytelling. And when you do that, you're not so quick to attribute actions or motives to certain people. You're more, I think, apt to see things moving in an organic process. So that Churchill would have said, just as that Iron Curtain descended, it would have eventually to rise again, and this time to be replaced by something more sheer, which is exactly what had happened. And if anything, if you ask me what brought about the fall of the Soviet Union, and I actually was asked a lot about this after I'd written my biography on Orwell, is I would say it was inertia. The regime could not have the dynamic force it needed to keep what was in effect an empire alive. The only reason the British Empire lasted as long as it did is there was a hell of a lot of dynamic energy in that empire, especially in the early days of building it. And if we lose what figurative empire we have, it will also be because we've lost that dynamic energy as well, or we've allowed it to get diluted or even distorted by, as Twain would have said, misadventures abroad that should never have taken place. And by the way, I just point out real quickly, another great lesson from Churchill's life, which is so stunning in its application today, is that Churchill emphasized again and again that for an island nation, the most important thing was its navy. And then later, when aviation was introduced, and he helped to introduce it into Britain and their military forces, that aviation and the naval power were the saviors. And yet what happened in the First World War was such great tragedy. A nation supreme in aviation and in naval power fought a grinding, brutal land war and essentially came to a draw. And what is happening now, I think, is stunning, because who has the greatest navy and the greatest air force on earth? We do. And what are we fighting? A miserable, awful, grinding land war in two places far from home. It's as though you've decided to fight with your worst or your weakest weapons in the wrong place. And that's the lesson that Churchill took away from the trench warfare of World War I. And you know what he suggested? The next war would have to be fought with an invention he was the first to champion, the tank. Because he was so convinced that there should not be another trench warfare in which thousands and thousands of people would be killed in just an awful war. if wars were necessary, they had to be fought with your best weapons at the place of your choice, not with your worst weapons in places that others chose for you. And I think that's a powerful lesson. If we're going to get into these things, we need to get into them with our strengths, not with our weaknesses.
We have time for one last question. What do you want to? Okay, got it.
Well, back to the language of 900 words. There seems to be an anti-elitist or anti-intellectual atmosphere in this country. Anyone who does speak well gets ridiculed or criticized that they're not one of the people. And what do you think, is that a correct analysis of what's happening? And what do you
you've
think
just
you can
asked,
do about that?
You've asked an excellent question, and Orwell answered it again. He anticipated some of these things. He has a great phrase, and you'll know it if you know British culture very well or if you've ever watched My Fair Lady. And it is this phrase, the English are branded on the tongue, meaning that dialect was such a defining, and vocabulary, was such a defining thing in England that the moment you opened your mouth, you defined yourself. And one of the things I experienced as American working in England for so many years is that I went right over the top of that because I softened my oaky accent and I had a rather soft voice to begin with and I had a professor's vocabulary. I didn't have to deal with any of those defining moments you get in England where immediately you're known to be from the Midlands or from the north of England or you're from Cornwall and you've got a dialect as well. And wading through all that, I realized how awful that is and how wonderful it is that in America, when we're at our best, and I often see this on university campuses, you can have those dialogues with pretty high-powered vocabulary and you can have them on a fairly equal footing. But out in the larger culture, yes, there's still a great deal of suspicion of people who have large vocabularies and who speak too fluently. And that's a great shame, and it's something that people have to stand up against. But we often get, I think, on our C-SPAN programs and on our news programs, we get very pretentious people sometimes using these vocabularies in a way that Americans, I think, instinctively react against. Perhaps if we had more Okies out there who could show that you could use language in a way that was versatile, and yet you didn't have to pronounce as if on high about these matters. You could just have a discussion. If we had a lot more of that, I think there would be less of what you're talking about, but you're absolutely right. There is that mood out there, and a lot of it is just simply irrational. It's an irrational dislike of a certain level of dialogue that perhaps people feel cut out or cut off from because they don't have the vocabulary or they haven't acquired the vocabulary to participate in that.
It's also, I think, a conflation of two things as you take that imagery of the good vocabulary. But historically, people have been fooled by people who are smarter than they are for thousands of years into miserable lives, and I think that is also at the base of anti-intellectual fervor, unfortunately. And it's very hard, unless you're taught to think about the difference, to take the two things apart and just say there are some people. You can tell the difference between people who have that education who are out to help you and those who are really out to fool you. Well, thank you very much, Michael, for that great talk.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
And we also thank our audience here at the club as well as our listening audience on the radio and online. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California held during its 107th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.